Every morning, find me moaning, 'cause of all the trouble I seen. Life's a losing gamble to me. Cares and woes have got me moaning. Every evening, find me moaning. I'm alone and crying the blues. I'm so tired of paying these dues. Everybody knows I'm moaning. Lord, I spend plenty of days and nights alone with my grief. But I pray, really and truly pray, somebody will come and bring me relief. Every morning, find me moaning, 'cause of all the trouble I seen. Life's a losing gamble to me. Everybody knows I'm moaning.
Moaning. This is Lead Stories. I'm your Trace Lead. It is Monday, June the 10th, and Senator John McCain is pushing for war. Well, not the real out-and-out war, you understand. More like an intervention. Well, not quite like an intervention, but more like leadership. More like the kind of leadership that lets the entire world know that we're in charge kind of leadership. Well, you may recall that John McCain, the Republican from Arizona, had paid a secret visit to Syria and came back more convinced than ever that the United States must absolutely be involved. Because, he says, the wrong side is winning in Syria, the wrong side being the elected president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad. And it is his idea that the United States should intervene precisely at this moment because, although at one point it looked like Assad was absolutely sure to fall under coordinated attacks from so-called rebels, among whom are said to be al-Qaeda members. In fact, when McCain was there himself, he was escorted around by some folk who raised an eyebrow or two. They were identified in the Beirut-based Daily Star newspaper as people who were said to have kidnapped 11 Lebanese Shiite pilgrims in May of last year. Of course, McCain's office denied that that was so. They said they have no proof of that. And that, of course, the senator was not in the company of such individuals. But in any event, the issue is not that. The issue is what is going to be the U.S.'s position in Syria now that the wrong side is winning. So just to give you a very brief snapshot into his view, here we go. This is Senator McCain saying that the U.S. should lead in Syria. He's talking to the Brookings Institution just last week.
The entire Middle East is now up for grabs, and our enemies are fully committed to winning. Moderate forces and aspiring Democrats are fighting for their futures and their very lives. The only power that is not fully committed in this struggle is us. And as a result, leaders and people across the region who share our interests and many of our values are losing ground to violent extremists. Our friends and allies in the Middle East are crying out for American leadership, as I heard again last week. We must answer this call. We must lead. We need an alternative strategy that creates space for moderate leaders to marginalize extremists and for people to resolve their differences peacefully, politically. An alternative strategy must begin with a credible Syria policy. I want a negotiated end to this settlement. So do we all. But anyone who thinks that Assad and his allies will ever make peace when they are winning on the battlefield is delusional. I know that the situation in Syria is hugely complicated and that there's no easy or ideal options. But we have to be realistic. This conflict will grind on with all of its worsening consequences until the balance of power shifts against Assad and his allies. And the longer we wait to take action, the more action we will have to take.
Well, that's his view. And interestingly, it's driving a cleavage within the Republican Party. There are folks who have an entirely different take, and we'll hear soon from Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who's expressing a point of view that should rattle the rest of us. Here is the Senator McCain. He is saying, let us get involved now. Let's do it like we've never done it before to put an end to this regime. We don't like Assad. He ought to go. We all agree with that. I don't know who the we is, but he's, of course, speaking for us, as many people in the Senate and in the House tend to do. But the idea is to get him out and get a government, you know, the normal formula. You get a government that you like or a government that you can deal with. And there are many reasons that the United States cannot deal with Assad. That will take a whole other program. But it was very striking that the voice of dissent should come from within the party itself, and it rattled Senator McCain last week. Here's Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky saying that if McCain's plan were to be followed, what the United States actually will be doing is arming al-Qaeda.
Does any other member have an amendment to call up? Senator Paul.
Mr. Chairman, our nation is weary of war. We've been at war for over a decade in two main countries, Afghanistan and Iraq. I don't think we're eager to get into another war. I talk to our young men and women who have volunteered to fight in war. I think it's not a good idea to get involved in Syria. I think it's a very murky war with so many different factions. It's hard to know who are our friends, who aren't our friends, who you should arm, who you shouldn't arm. I don't think anybody can sit here in Washington and say, well, I'm confident these weapons are only going to a good, you know, liberty-loving, Jeffersonian, you know, type of Democrats in Syria, and that bad people aren't going to get these weapons. So I'm very concerned about giving weapons. I think also, when you think about the amendment that I'm offering, the First Amendment, it clarifies that the 2001 use of authorization of force does not authorize intervention in Syria. This is stating another way what we are already stating in the bill, that this is not a use of authorization of force. But it goes to the heart of the debate we're going to have that Senator Corker has talked about having about the definition of the original use of authorization of force in Afghanistan that's come to mean anything. And I think it's important that we state explicitly what we think it means. There is a great irony here in the sense that if you wanted to believe in an expansive definition of the 2001 use of authorization of force, it says go after al-Qaeda and associated forces. Well, al-Qaeda and associated forces are opposing Assad. So if you want to believe in an expansive definition of the 2001 AUMF, you might believe that you could actually support Assad with arms, that the original use of authorization of force actually would justify giving arms to Assad. And I'm not proposing that. But I am proposing that you will be giving arms to the side that is fighting against Assad that has elements of al-Qaeda. There is a great irony there. I am also saying that in your rush to get involved in Syria, that you may well be arming Islamic rebels who will be shooting Christians. There's about somewhere between 1 million and 2 million Christians in Syria. They have been largely protected by Assad. I'm once again not saying Assad's a good guy, but I'm saying that they've been a protected minority by Assad for decades because he's a minority and it's been practical for him. They haven't taken a large position in the war. They're in the middle of this, but they tend to live in areas and have been protected by the Assad regime. When push comes to shove, I think there'll be a great irony and tragedy and sadness if you sent arms with U.S. taxpayer money to kill Christians. I think it could happen. I think it's impossible to know who our friends are. Look at how much trouble we have in Afghanistan. We have an ally that we've had for 10 years, and we don't know who to trust in the Afghan army. You know, we've had probably nearly 100 deaths from Afghan soldiers. They lie. They come in and say they're our ally, and they take a pledge to support us, and we turn the other way, and they shoot us. And Syria's a much messier situation, maybe 100 times messier than Afghanistan is. I know everybody here wants to do the right thing, but I think it's a rush to war. Now, people will say, oh, you're not putting troops on the ground. Well, we are going to have capacity building. There is no limitation in this bill on where those troops can do capacity building. I'm assuming it's going to be more in Jordan and other places. There's no limitation here that the troops, U.S. troops, can't be on the ground in Syria. So this resolution could be arming rebels, who even the Joint Chief of Staff have said it's unclear, and it's increasingly unclear who our friends are, and it's increasingly difficult to determine who our friends are. He says in the last 6 months, it's become harder to determine who our friends are. This is the Joint Chief of Staff, who I would think would be privy to a lot of information and whose opinion and weight should be listened to carefully. So I'm very concerned about arming the rebels. I'm concerned about getting more involved. I'm concerned about the slippery slope into war. War doesn't always start with a huge battle or bombing run. Sometimes it starts with advisors. It did in Vietnam. Sometimes it starts with arming one group for the other. People may remember in Vietnam we had trouble because we didn't like some of the leaders. They were either corrupt or not good enough fighters, and so we got rid of Diem, or we let others get rid of Diem, or we watched over that. But we were always trying to look for better leaders, people who were stronger leaders. But the ones who emerge may well not be the ones we like. We think we can change the outcome. I'm not sure we can. But there will be a great tragedy if American arms fall into al-Nusra and to extremist elements in Syria. And I really regret that. I will vote against the entire bill, but I would like to present mine for a recorded vote, which basically says that the use of authorization of force from 2001 does not authorize intervention in Syria. You've already agreed to have this stated in a different way in the bill, that this bill doesn't do it. But now we're going to say, if you vote for this, that you believe that the use of authorization of force really had a little bit to do with Afghanistan, which I think it was primarily intended to, and that the language does not authorize war and intervention anywhere in the world, anytime.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rand Paul. He voices a very interesting, different point of view. However, you see how convoluted it gets. Don't arm the rebels because they'll kill Christians. It's okay if they kill just Muslims, but now, according to Rand Paul, he's troubled by the fact that they will kill Christians. But the overall point that he's trying to make is, no matter what you do, what is the point of getting involved right now when we cannot really get a clear reading of the landscape? And when, in fact, arming the so-called rebels is really arming al-Qaeda. That was the whole point about Benghazi. That was the whole point about it. All these arms that were stacked up and stored in Benghazi waiting for shipment into Syria have gone also to opponents of Assad, who is not a favorite of al-Qaeda movements in the region. And they would have ended up with the arms. That's the whole secret about what's going on in Benghazi. And that's why we need to have thorough hearings about Benghazi. Now, John Kerry, our new Secretary of State, supposedly, according to the Associated Press, has cleared his schedule to discuss arming Syrian rebels. And this is a week when everybody's talking about transparency. Transparency is the name of the theme this past week. Everybody wants things to be very transparent. Well, I haven't heard very much about what the president or the secretary of state intends to do about arming Syrian rebels. This is how this is done. So please keep that in mind. We'll be following that story. It would be unfolding. But here is the great conundrum of them all. A senator who supposedly doesn't like war insists that we must go to war. Got to go to war. He went for a secret trip. He's hanging out with the people who did some pretty evil things, according to a newspaper. They were the kidnappers of Shiites a year ago and counting. Of course, McCain says he doesn't know anything about that, which tells you about the nature of what's going on in that part of the world. It's very complicated. You don't know who is who. But Mr. McCain is absolutely sure that we ought to be involved. Arming the rebels, which is to say, assisting Al-Qaeda, or declaring a no-fly zone, which is in itself an act of war. When you declare a no-fly zone, basically you're saying that the country's own air force cannot fly in such and such an area or risk being shot down by your planes. This is pretty much war. That's how it starts. And the rationale on the other side is, well, we shouldn't give them any assistance right now because we don't know who we're arming. And in any event, we have an issue here about what's going to happen to the Christians. The United States will be funding the Muslim rebels and encouraging them to kill Christians. So, yeah, okay. So we'll be following that story. I just wanted you to see how odd the reasoning is in Washington as we go. Then we come to Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden, as you know, since he has revealed himself, his identity, from a hotel room in Hong Kong. He's a 29-year-old defense contractor who revealed that it was he who leaked these classified documents about U.S. surveillance programs that basically have us all under their microscope without our knowledge. And, of course, it's a very serious thing. And it has gotten a lot of traction, and people are talking about it. As well they should, because it does suggest that the government is kind of out of hand. But I have some thoughts about this. And I wonder, did he suddenly have some kind of an epiphany, a moral conviction, pangs of conscience? Or is there something else happening here? I vote for something else happening here. Here's a guy making $200,000 a year. Nobody put a gun to his head to go get a job with the CIA. I mean, what do you have to know? What else do you need to know about the CIA that you should expect something different? You're doing clandestine work. That's what they do. So the mere fact that you're working in that field, you volunteered for that job, means somehow or the other you at one point were okay with it. Now, did something happen on the job? And by the way, at $200,000 a year, you know, he's said to be a high school dropout. I can't tell you how many people with doctorates are interested in earning $200,000 a year. But anyway, something about this is just not sitting right with me. And I question the intensity of coverage, this outrage that people suddenly have. And I wonder how come there's this sudden outrage about the government overreaching its boundaries. I'm asking the question, when didn't it? When was this not the case? certainly in the African-American community, it's been long understood that a whole bunch of people were under direct surveillance of the U.S. government for many, many, many years. That's just what COINTELPRO is all about. So to introduce this idea as something new, that the government is spying on us and there's this secret court, it has been there for a long time. These are the courts that okayed black bag jobs. This was the very court that okayed the bugging of people's homes, Martin Luther King's bedroom, for example, and other people's homes. This is the work they do. So this gentleman, Mr. Snowden, comes forward. His motives are not questioned because he states that he has pretty much a pang of conscience. He is doing a great moral duty. And I'm not trying to make fun of it. I'm just saying there's something there that is just not clicking right. Because, like I said, he wasn't dragged off the street. He volunteered for this kind of work. This was what he wanted to do. But there's another side of it that is hypocritical, and that is, if you're going to get angry with the U.S. government for having so much information and the ability to read into our lives at any moment, I haven't heard a similar case being made about Google and Facebook and Yahoo and AOL and Apple and other entities that routinely pry into our lives every single day. You can go on a site, and the next thing you know, you're getting ads and you're getting material sent to you out of nowhere. You have no clue how this is going, but they're merchandising us. They're merchandising our information every single day. They're putting together profiles of each user every single day for money. So if we're going to get angry about it, how come we're not angry with Zuckerberg? Are we not angry with Zuckerman? We're not angry with a number of other folks who are in the high-tech world, who absolutely covet the information we supply them. The information was used by Barack Obama for his election, and is still being used by his election. You remember here we discussed the story about the fight of the Democrats wanting to fight over his massive mailing lists and the computer records and so forth. This is, they collect information and they massage information for all kinds of reasons. We have no idea. You might have gone on to the Obama site and, thinking that you were trying to just help a brother get elected. And next thing you know, they have all kinds of profiles of you that are worth money to them, certainly to get elected. But you don't know where this information is ending up. The fact is, if we're going to have a standard, let's have one standard. We should be outraged about the fact that these things exist, but also this is how the world is working. I am not by any means comfortable with any of this, nor do I endorse any of this. I'm saying that we should keep our heads on our shoulders about this, because we have a tendency, because it is pointing to the government doing something evil. And again, it only is an outrage because it had been practiced before on other folks, and it was perfected by these agencies on other folks. So where was the great outcry about COINTELPRO? Where was a great outcry in much of the 60s? A lot of people still from the 60s are still being looked at very closely. The activities are still looked at very closely. The African-American community, the Latino community, certainly are very much accustomed to being under heavy surveillance. But, of course, when these communities are suffering things like this, we find that people say, well, gee, you know, that's too bad, and they shrug it off. It's just, it ain't happening to me. But now it is, so now it becomes a problem. The whole collection of data is affecting an entirely different community, so now it's a problem. Now it's a real problem. And we have people like Ed Snowden, again, somebody who volunteered for this work. This is what he signed up for. And if he has had some kind of a change of heart, well, say that, but don't come out saying, well, the government is wrong. No, you knew what you were getting into. Now, the information is useful, certainly, because it does point to quite an aggressive move on the part of the Obama administration, the irony being that this particular president had sworn to everybody that it was going not to be like the Bush administration. It was going to be far more transparent. But other than that, frankly, I hope you could appreciate the fact that I'm not amazed by the fact that this young man has validated something that we should have known all along. We're 40 years late. We'll take this break and come back right after this. Jose James with Monin. This is Utrice Lead. You're listening to Lead Stories right here on PRN.FM. We are going to be following the Trayvon Martin case, but of course it is a George Zimmerman case. Zimmerman facing second-degree murder charges in the shooting death of Trayvon Martin just last year. And, of course, jury selection begins today in that trial. Now, you will recall at the beginning, the defense lawyers for George Zimmerman had seemed that they were going to be making the stand your ground defense. And then, surprisingly, fairly late in the game, they decided that they were not going to do that. And instead, they will approach his defense on the merits of, you know, arguing on the second-degree murder charge and defending against that charge instead. After having a hearing in the court, they notified the court that they will no longer be pursuing the stand your ground defense. Since we are going to be discussing this case for quite a while, it will last at least another month or so, we need to appreciate what is this stand your ground case, because here's what's going to happen. I'm going to make a prediction. Although they are not officially going to discuss the case as a stand your ground case, I will bet my bottom dollar that they will try to introduce elements of the same claim coming in the back door with it, because it will only strengthen their defense. Even though they said they're not pursuing it, they're going to bring it through the back door. So at some point we will hear elements of it, but we need to appreciate what the elements of the arguments are. So here is a nice, like a primer, if you will, on Stand Your Ground. We're going to be hearing from a well-known defense attorney in Florida, who, his name is William Schaefer, who has attracted a certain amount of notoriety or fame or acclamation in the state for defending against capital cases and murder charges, drug trafficking charges, and white-collar crime. He speaks here to a group of the League of Women Voters in Florida, in Oviedo, Florida, and he's talking to them, explaining the elements of the Stand Your Ground defense and the Stand Your Ground law. What are the important pieces to be met in order to qualify for defense under the Stand Your Ground law? It's a sizable clip, but it is very instructive. And for that, I have to thank the Carol McKinney Public Media of Oviedo, Florida, for this recording. So we go now to William Schaefer discussing the Stand Your Ground law in light of the possibility of its application in this trial of George Zimmerman.
From Carol McKinney Public Media in Oviedo, Florida.
The statute just simply reads that a person who is not engaged in an unlawful activity and who is attacked in any other place where he or she has a right to be has no duty to retreat and has the right to stand his or her ground and meet force with force, including deadly force, if he or she reasonably believes it is necessary to do so to prevent death or great bodily harm to himself or herself or another, or to prevent the commission of a forcible felony.
Those words constitute both a Florida law, on which recent events have focused much attention, and a law about which one of Central Florida's most recognized criminal defense attorneys addresses in this podcast. Hello, I'm Stephen McKinney Stack for CMF Public Media. Attorney William J. Schaefer is the voice you heard reading from the state statute containing what is commonly known as the Stand Your Ground law. CMF Public Media recorded Schaefer's remarks made at a recent luncheon meeting of the Seminole County League of Women Voters, to which he was invited expressly to address that law and the issues surrounding it, particularly in light of the possibility of that law being applied to the defense of Sanford, Florida resident George Zimmerman in connection with Zimmerman's arrest on charges of second-degree murder surrounding the death of Trayvon Martin. Attorney Schaefer's bio notes his law practice includes defenses for a wide range of serious felonies, from murder in the first degree, conspiracy and drug trafficking charges, to sex offenses and complex white-collar crimes. Outside of the courtroom, most recognize Schaefer from his local television role as a legal analyst for Orlando's ABC News affiliate, WFTV Channel 9. There, he gained recognition for his explanations and insights regarding the Kaylee Anthony murder trial. Amid almost 2 years of local and global media attention, that trial brought to Central Florida. Today, Schaefer continues his analysis for WFTV in the George Zimmerman case and the implications the Stand Your Ground law has had to the charge and pending criminal trial. Schaefer's remarks to the League of Women Voters last 24 minutes, followed by 16 minutes of answers to questions on the law asked by League members. On our webpage, we have included a link to the state statute, as well as links to the articles from the Tampa Bay Times newspaper to which Schaefer refers in his remarks. Schaefer begins his comments by noting why Florida's Stand Your Ground law is unique among other states having a similar law.
Florida is unique in the sense that self-defense and the use of deadly force in self-defense has long been recognized in the United States and actually goes back to English common law. What makes Florida's non-retreat or stand your own ground unique is that feature that doesn't require you, if you're in a location where you have the right to be and you're not engaging in unlawful activity, you have no right to or obligation to retreat You can greet force, and you can greet force with deadly force. That's what makes Florida's Stand Your Ground law unique. There are several provisions in this Stand Your Ground law that has really turned out to be problematic for the courts and the court system. The statute just simply reads that a person who is not engaged in an unlawful activity and who is attacked in any other place where he or she has a right to be has no duty to retreat and has the right to stand his or her ground and meet force with force, including deadly force, if he or she reasonably believes it is necessary to do so to prevent death or great bodily harm to himself or herself or another, or to prevent the commission of a forcible felony. Now, this takes off a little bit, by the way, from what we call the Castle Doctrine. If you're in your home or you're in your automobile and I come to your home and attempt to gain entry, it's presumed that I have a bad intent, and quite frankly, you can use deadly force to stop me then and there. All right? If you're in your automobile, it is the same situation. That's called the Castle Doctrine. What this Stand Your Ground law has done is it has expanded that no duty to retreat that you have in the Castle Doctrine to any other area that you might be, as long as you're not engaged in illegal activity and you have a right to be where you're supposed to be. That's pretty simple, and it's pretty common sense, you would think. Here's where we start to have problems, because the statute doesn't stop there. What it does is it expands the application of this Stand Your Own Ground, and it expands it to that a person who uses force as permitted under the statute that I just read to you is justified in using such force and is immune from criminal prosecution and civil action for the use of such force. It goes on, but that's the important area of that. And as used in the subsection, the term criminal prosecution includes arresting, detaining in custody, and charging or prosecuting the defendant. A law enforcement agency may use standard procedure for investigating the use of force as described above, but the agency may not arrest the person for using force unless it determines that there is probable cause that the force that was used was unlawful. There's where we have our first issues that are causing such problems with the court system. Let's talk about this and break this down. When a law enforcement officer investigates, and guess what? I am not shy about talking about and relating this to the case that has brought this statute, which has been used since 2005 on more than one occasion, but the problems with this statute have been brought to the forefront by the Zimmerman case. What law enforcement was confronted with at the time that they did this investigation was this provision that says you may not arrest unless there's probable cause to believe that the use of force was unlawful. Now, at first blush, you may say, well, it was an unarmed individual, and there should be a presumption that you would not have to use deadly force and shoot an unarmed person. That's not the end-all be-all, because I have had clients that have been engaged in combat with one another, and my client has actually pulled a gun because the other person reached into his jacket and he had a reputation for carrying a firearm. My client knew it. Well, my client shot him in the chest. Guess what? He wasn't armed. But we went to a jury trial. We didn't use Stand Your Own Ground. We used self-defense. And at that juncture, the jury, in fact, found the defendant not guilty, my client not guilty. What this statute has done is it now law enforcement can and has construed this may not arrest to shall not arrest. What we have done is we have taken investigators and police officers who are trained in law enforcement, and I'm not disparaging their training and their investigation. I'm not saying that the investigation in this case wasn't an adequate investigation and that the police under this statute didn't reach the right conclusion in sending this case to the state attorney's office. But what we have done is we have put law enforcement officers in the position of that of a lawyer and a judge. My criticism thus far of this statute, and I believe that the statute is a good statute, but there are some problems with it. This is one of the problems with it. Why do I say that? I say that because if, in fact, law enforcement does like they do in any other case, which is investigates the case and finds that there's probable cause to arrest, they should not be placed in a position of some sanction if they make the arrest and it, lo and behold, turns out that later a judge or a jury dismisses the case or finds the defendant not guilty. We have safety valves, if you will, all up and down the system. Here's what the safety valve is. If, in fact, Mr. Zimmerman had been arrested at that time and charged with a crime, that arrest and that affidavit goes to the state attorney's office. There are lawyers then who are trained in the law, trained in the nuances of the law, trained into as to when shall means shall, when may means you can, and the other vagaries and inconsistencies of the law in order to make a decision of whether or not to prosecute that case. So there have been the critics that suggest we do away with the law enforcement responsibility other than you investigate the case, and just like any other case, if you find probable cause, you either arrest or you send the case over to the state attorney's office and let them make that decision. The state attorney's office then, even if an arrest was made, has the power, regardless of this statute, has the power to say, we feel that from a legal standpoint, this case should not be prosecuted. The state attorney's office can, at that point, decline prosecution. Again, justice is served because the case has been reviewed by an assistant state attorney, and based upon the mandate of the Supreme Court, which is you do not file a case unless you in good faith believe you can prove it beyond and to the exclusion of every reasonable doubt, that's their standard, then that has been satisfied. We now have, based upon this statute, a separate determination made by a judge, and it's called your stand your ground immunity hearing. What does that mean? Under this statute, because it says that criminal prosecution includes arresting, detaining, and charging or prosecuting the defendant, the body of law has developed that has said, look, defendant, you have the right to, it's a mini trial, if you will, in front of a judge. Now, it's different from a criminal trial because in this immunity hearing, the burden is placed upon the defendant. In a criminal trial, as you all well know, the burden is on the state, and the burden for conviction is proof beyond and to the exclusion of every reasonable doubt. In this immunity hearing, which, by the way, it took the Florida Supreme Court 5 years before the Florida Supreme Court said that the immunity hearing is by the preponderance of the evidence, and a judge will decide on that basis. So it took them 5 years to to remove that ambiguity, if you will. Now, in this Stand Your Ground immunity hearing, which we're going to have one in this Zimmerman case, the reason being is whether or not you see this as a defense, whether this is just straight up self-defense or it's a Stand Your Ground defense at trial, certainly any criminal defense attorney is going to, because of this statute, turn around and claim Stand Your Ground so they can get this immunity hearing. It's a mini trial, and what the defense has to present is evidence by the preponderance, a preponderance of the evidence that, in fact, the use of deadly force in this case or any other case was lawful. Now, what is preponderance of the evidence? Preponderance of the evidence is 50.01%. All right? 50.01%. To put it another way, if I have a scale here and I have two platforms on that scale, if I drop a feather on one side and that feather causes the scale to tip ever so slightly, that's preponderance of the evidence. Very low threshold. So judges have to, in deciding whether or not to throw this case out at this immunity hearing, they have to take the credibility of the witnesses in the case and whether that person is to be believed or not. And usually what happens in these cases is somebody's dead. And there's usually only one person sitting there telling what happened. And if that person's credibility cannot be assailed by the state or otherwise shown to the judge that they should not be believed, if their testimony, even if there's some minor inconsistencies with the telling of the story, you chalk that up to the frailty of human memory, or even if there's a little bit of difference between the forensic evidence and the testimony of the defendant, unless there's something glaring there, that preponderance of the evidence, as told by the survivor of this encounter, is usually going to carry the day.
Jim Schaefer, talking about the, I thought he gave a pretty good explanation as to why the lawyers changed their mind about the Stand Your Ground case, and he got into some of the details there. But they are going to try and drag it through the back door. So we will be looking at that much deeper as we go along. I want to thank you for joining me today. We didn't have time to go into all of the tape, but sufficient to give you a sense of why the lawyers changed their tact and are going ahead with it as a straight defense case against a second-degree murder charge. But bet your bottom dollar they're going to drag in elements of Stand Your Ground in this case. Tomorrow, I'd love you to be here again tomorrow at the same time and tell someone to join you here as well. It's a great program planned for you tomorrow. And we will continue this discussion about Ed Snowden and the famous leaks. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.